Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, April 17th, 2025, and our friend Richard Wolf is back with us. Welcome back, Professor.
Thank you very much, Nima. Glad to be here.
Let's get started with what's going on between the United States and China and these escalations and somehow economic war between the two parties. Here is what the Chinese expert Victor Gao said about the way that China is going to respond to the United States.
Fight to the end, as the government has declared, and China has now imposed the retaliatory tariff up to 125% against all U.S. exports to China. Now, if things are not handled well, this means complete stop of China-U.S. trade, both ways. No goods exported from the United States to China, and complete stop of everything made in China to the United States. This is decoupling. If the United States wants to really welcome this, China will reciprocate, and causing the breakup of China-U.S. relations. Whether this will evolve from peace to war, well, let's all be prepared. In essence, what China now declares is that it is prepared to fight to the end, trade war, tariff war, technology war, or real war. So the ball is in Trump's court. You decide, and I will reciprocate. Mm. I will never succumb to the U.S. pressure. And this is the moment of truth. China wants to defend free trade. The United States wants to destroy free trade.
Right.
The rest of the world is watching, and there will be a choice by the end of the day. For China, you cannot hold a gun to China's head and issue ultimatum and demand all the impossibilities, for example, and ask China to swallow that. China is the country that values dignity and decency and honor more than economic gains or economic losses.
Richard, you see the tone and the way that they're responding to the United States. How deep are they going after this sort of economic war?
Well, as we have talked about on many occasions on your program, you, me, Michael Hudson, and so on, there is a changing in the world economy that we are part of, that we are living through. The United States is living through it. China is living through it. Everybody is living through it. It is a fundamental change, above all, because one empire, that of the United States, the absolute dominant unipolar moment, as it has been called by Professor Mearsheimer and others, is passing. The United States had its empire. It lasted, about 100 years. It came after the decline of the British Empire, so that the pound sterling once was the global currency, then it was the dollar that was the global currency. After World War II, as we have talked about, the United States was the overwhelmingly dominant economic power that was left standing after the horrible mutual destruction of everybody else who might have been an empire. World War II finished the British Empire. It finished the French, the German aspirations, which had already been destroyed in World War I, the Japanese, they were destroyed. The symbolism at the end of the United States, almost a monopolist in the atom bomb, dropping it on Japan. I mean, there you have, we are dominant, you are defeated. Okay? Now, for the rest of the 20th century, from the 1940s to the end of the century, and even into the early years of the current century, the United States played that role. Of course it welcomed free trade, because it was in the best position to take advantage of free trade. They didn't want barriers anywhere. They wanted open competition, because between their economic power, their political power, their ideological power, and their military power, who was going to do as well as they were in a global market? So they had wonderful ideas. The profit and richness of American capitalism would now expand to take the whole world. And that's how they thought. And the people who lead the United States today, whether they are Democrats or Republicans, are people who've lived their whole adult life from childhood through the universities or colleges, schooling, into their political power position with the United States as dominant. You must understand that to grasp the difficulty for them when it turns out that their expectation, their hope, their assumption that this would last forever comes to a screeching halt when suddenly somebody else is rising. It's as if the country here forgot its own history. It was a small, poor corner of the British Empire here in North America. And it became the child that not only outgrew the parent, but subordinated the parent. Britain is now the poor corner of the American Empire, not America, the poor corner of the British Empire. And now China. China emerges. What was it? A very poor corner of the British and American empires, abusively treated by both of them. And now, through a whole host of spectacular adjustments that the Chinese made to their impoverished situation, they found a way to grow their economy faster than Britain ever did, faster than the United States ever did. And in 40 years, they become what? The powerhouse that they are today. And they have been very, very successful at doing it. And let's be clear before I explain what this means. The Chinese are not only an immense economy now, but they had a particular strategy. And that strategy was to become the low-cost, high-quality manufacturing center of the whole global economy, taking advantage of the globalization that the United States organized as its market, as its framework, and then to become successful by producing the same goods and services that the West was producing, but of a better quality and a lower price, often both. As in, for example, solar panels, or as in AI, or as in electric vehicles, all of which they now produce the best quality in the world at the lowest price. They succeeded in doing it, and it isn't all that difficult. Japan earlier did something quite similar. They went to work, for example, to defeat the West that had overwhelmed Japan by producing the automobile more cheaply and of a better quality, to take that area, that niche. And it's not only that, but that was a particular focus of the Japanese. And they built an economy out of it. They built a place for themselves in the world economy. The Chinese have done it. They're a much bigger country than Japan. They have much bigger history and, you know, all of that. So they went to work and they have now done that. And so the question is, they have arrived and they want their economy to grow. They have lifted 700 or 800 million people out of poverty in the last few years. They are therefore better at what? Well, they're better at what they have organized themselves to be. They understand, partly it's their Marxism and their communism, but partly it's ancient Chinese philosophy too. They are aware that one of the weaknesses of Western capitalism is its inequality in the way that it has, you know, Elon Musk and then the 50 million people who can't get through next week in the United States. What is, they understand that that is socially unsustainable. It is socially destabilizing to organize your economy. So they're not going to do that. And they have the government power because of the Communist Party and the way their government is structured. They have this hybrid economy, half state enterprises, half private enterprises, and they can use the power of the state to mediate, to control these two parts with an end result that is much more efficient. That's the sad truth of it, than Western capitalism privately owned. That's, they've shown that. There's not a debate anymore, except for ideologues who don't want to see what they have accomplished and what they are continuing to accomplish. And one more crucial thing. They understood, as a latecomer to the world of modern industrialization, that they better have real serious allies, not merely transact, but they needed to build on what they could find to give them a community of allied nations. In a world of nation building and nation mentality, they had to come up with some kind of genuine internationalism. And the way they did that, brilliant in my judgment, is they positioned themselves as a member, dues-paying member of the global South. They positioned themselves as part of that world which European, American, and Japanese colonialism had repressed. And what that did is enable them, particularly in the last 10 years, to develop the BRICS. And that is crucial. It's not just the original BRICS. You know, South Africa, Russia, India, Brazil, and China. But the 15 are roughly more countries that have joined on one capacity or another, partner or member of the BRICS. It is so important right now because the United States is decoupling from China. And let's be real clear, it's the United States that took the initiative to do this. The United States broke. The United States imposed tariffs first. When the Chinese retaliated, they almost always retaliated very carefully, less than the United States. So if the United States is 145%, they stop at 125. That's very symbolic, but it is very smart because it teaches the whole world the cause of this whole problem is the United States. It makes the interventions first. But the problem of the United States, given its situation, in its desperation to survive what it takes to be the terrible decline of its empire, it is sacrificing its alliances because it is so frightened, it is so desperate in its situation that even to its border, Canada and Mexico, it becomes aggressive, it becomes angry, it becomes grabbing, it would take Canada, take Mexico's this, or extraordinary. But look at the difference. The United States alienating Canada, Mexico, Europe, whereas the Chinese are building the BRICS. You could not have a more dramatic differentiation. But now let's really hone in on it. China will react to the decoupling with the United States by doing what Russia did when the United States became the support for the Ukrainians. What Russia did was turn to the BRICS, and it saved them. It meant that the economic sanctions of the West did not work. They failed. They were supposed to bring Russia to its knees, that was supposed to collapse the ruble. The ruble, by the way, right now is one of the most rapidly rising currencies in the whole world the last few months. So the BRICS saved Russia. The BRICS are now going to save China. Why? Because the BRICS is over half the population of this planet. Somewhere 50 to 60% of the people of this world live in a BRICS member country. China will now turn to them. What it can't sell here, it will sell there. What it can't buy from the United States, it will buy from them. And we're talking about every continent, every part of the world, whose alliances were strengthened by Russia during the Ukraine war, just in time for China, who was supportive of Russia during the Ukraine war, to turn around and get support from Russia in return, which, as far as I can tell, will be forthcoming for them. And that's very, very important. And the United States, that's 4.5% of the world's people. Not 50 to 60%, 4.5%, with less going for its allies. The Europeans are not going to be in a very good mood to help Americans. They are bitter at what is being purchased at their expense. The United States making all kinds of plans that leave the Europeans high and dry, including the tariffs and all of that. So you are looking at a situation which, of course, because in the United States, one is not allowed in general to be honest about what's going on. We live in a highly politically polarized society, and we have a long history of not wanting to acknowledge the empire that we sit on. So this is difficult for Americans to learn about, to understand, to see in any way. The Chinese are positioned now with a kind of automatic demonization. I want to remind everyone, when you hear all the noise that we're now going to hear about the evil Chinese, just remember, it wasn't just a few months ago that Mr. Putin was the worst imaginable leader on earth. He was a Stalin. Our president referred to him as a thug, you know, a criminal. What in the world are you doing? And before that, it was Saddam Hussein. And before that, it was Muammar Gaddafi. And one monster after we are the wonderful Democrats surrounded by the evil monsters and the dictator. Extraordinary. You live in a country that lives almost in a medieval bifurcation of good and evil, and everything is reduced to that story. And that, I wouldn't mind that. I mean, that would be a cultural peculiarity, except it is leading us to make one mistake after another. Let me end on that point. The war in Ukraine, I'm going to exaggerate a bit, but not by much. The war in Ukraine was lost because the United States thought that the mother of all sanctions by Europe and the United States together, focused on Russia, would destroy Russia. There were even thoughts it would break up, Mr. Putin would be thrown out, it would dissolve into little countries that could then be picked off by NATO the way Eastern Europe was over the last 20 years. That failed totally. Why? Because Russia had the BRICS. The current policy with China will fail for the exact same reason. America, the leaders in America can't get their heads around the fact that they have been outmaneuvered, outgrown. The Chinese found a way for economic development. The Chinese found a way to do what every poor country in Asia, Africa, and Latin America wants to do: economic growth quickly, so they aren't so poor anymore. The Chinese did it better, faster than anybody else has ever done it. So of course they are the leader there. What would you expect? And no one's going to change that. The United States cannot imaginarily do away with what I just said. And the power of that across this planet is overwhelming. And if you don't take it into account, you misunderstand the situation you face, and you're going to make strategic mistakes. The sanctions war against Russia failed. It gave Russia the time and the space to mobilize its military and to win the military war on the ground in Ukraine, which they have done. And the decoupling strategy, which is the same, or tariffs. Tariffs is another way of whacking the world, just like sanctions is a way of whacking the world. What you are doing, the irony of ironies, you're bringing Russia and China closer together. You did that through the war in Ukraine. You're about to do it again. You're making the same mistake. You're not learning that you have a problem here, and that problem isn't going to go away. Look, Britain, as I think I've mentioned on this show, Britain tried to prevent the United States, even though it was in those days a poor corner of the British Empire. They didn't want it to break away. So they went to war, 1776. They went to war. They lost. They didn't understand. A few years later, in 1812, they did it again, and they lost again. After two wars, two losers, two losses, they didn't do it anymore. We don't have that luxury because of nuclear weapons. We can't go through two wars with China to figure out what I just said. We actually have to do it by thinking where we've been in the past, what it meant, how it worked out, what our latest misadventure in Ukraine. This is not a winnable situation for the mentality of the 20th century. The 20th century is over, and the American empire is over with it. We are not a nation of 4.5% of the people of this planet. We are not in a position to overwhelm the BRICS with 50 to 60% of the world's people and two or more nuclear powers among them. And this becomes lunatic. That's not where we're going in the world. We're not doing that. The global South will not sit there and permit this to happen. And all the military power in the world will not change that. The reality is what it is, and only foolish people or crazy people persist in doing what isn't working. I hate to be so strong about it, but it is the reality, and it means that this noise with China is really a waste of everybody's time. The prospects for China among the BRICS in maintaining growth are much better than the prospects of the United States without its allies. Somehow, that's a kind of megalomania that thinks like that. And if you go too far, you will do enough damage that it will be very difficult to come back from that situation. I'll tell you the story, if I can, of one example, and just string it out so you can see the implications. The BYD Corporation, Build Your Dream, I believe, is what BYD stands for. The BYD Corporation is a Chinese corporation that makes electric vehicles, cars and trucks. And it makes what is globally recognized to be the highest quality at the lowest price. They recently got even more famous because they produced a battery for their electric vehicles that takes 5 minutes to charge, which none of the existing batteries can go that quickly. It takes about as much time as filling up your car with gasoline has been taking with that, which was one of the big problems of that industry. It has so successful that it is now a larger seller of vehicles than Tesla, which was the first in the electric car area. Tesla is now shrinking. The stock price is falling. Mr. Musk will have to live with a little less than $400 billion assets to his name. BYD is emerging. Now, what does that mean? Well, obviously, it means that in the competition among all the car companies in the world to develop the best, cheapest, highest quality electric car, the Chinese came in number one. That's already a very remarkable story. But that's only the beginning. That's what I mean by stringing it out for you. Now hear what's going to happen. The United States, reacting to what the Chinese have achieved, not by figuring out how can we learn what they did, how can we replicate what they achieved? No, no, no. First Mr. Trump and then Mr. Biden put an enormous tariff. Many Americans don't seem to know that. There's a tariff of 100% that has been in effect already before Mr. Trump became president again. Mr. Biden raised Trump's tariff of 27.5% all the way up to 100%. That means that no BYD cars come into the United States. If you travel this country, as I do, you will not see a BYD vehicle. But if you travel the roads of Europe, you will. Of Asia, Africa, and America, and South America, you will. Because they are the best vehicle. If you have a taxi company, you're going to buy that car because that's your best source of input. If you're a company that uses trucks for anything, you will be buying the best truck at the lowest price, which is BYD. American companies competing with people in every other part of the world will not be able to buy the cheapest, best truck. They'll have to do with a more expensive, less good vehicle. You know what that means? That means all American companies based here are put at a disadvantage in the world market because they have a much more expensive vehicles they have to buy of a lower quality than all their competitors elsewhere in the world. Do you understand? That is damaging the economic future of the United States and privileging the economic future of all our competitors abroad, especially the Chinese, so that this tariff backfires on the United States. It doesn't achieve even what it sets out to achieve. It doesn't protect the United States economy in the long run. It undermines it. Look, this is not advanced rocket science. This is what economics has learned over the years. Tariffs are not a new phenomena. They've been in existence, used by countries for hundreds of years. If you go to any library and you look up tariff, there'll be hundreds of books and thousands of articles examining what tariff was used in this situation. How did it work? Did it succeed? Did it fail? If it failed, why did it? We know all that. If you teach a course in international trade, you teach about tariffs, among other topics. Doing what we're doing now And having the president, who clearly never took an economics course, or if he did, doesn't remember what he learned, to have him tell you, I'm doing a tariff and it'll have this effect, is ludicrous. Nobody can do that. He can't. I can't. A tariff, the effect of a tariff, depends on everything else going on in the environment when you do that. Therefore, to do it always involves a big, fat risk that it could go this way or that way, and I can give you examples of when it went this way and when it went that way. You don't know. Mr. Trump acts like he knows. Maybe he thinks that's what a president should do, pretend to know what he couldn't possibly know. But for the rest of us watching, this is craziness. Now, is it possible that the tariffs will have the effect Mr. Trump wants? Yes. It's not a zero probability. Sometimes tariffs do what clearly Mr. Trump hopes they will do. But that's all he's got, a hope. The idea that he has masterfully, that's silly. That's just silly. Meanwhile, the risk he has taken, every country in the world is hurt because almost every country exports stuff to the United States because we've been one of the richest countries on earth for 50 years. So every country, sooner or later, the producers in every other country find a market here in the United States. So he has just hurt all of them. In one act, he made life difficult for every exporting company and country in the world. Those people don't like the United States more because we did that. They don't like Mr. Trump more because he did that. Not at all. They are angry. They are bitter. Their economic situation has now been damaged. Every leader of every country in the world now has an invitation to blame the economic difficulties of his or her country on the United States. And there will always be some truth to that. They're not going to limit it to the truth part. They will excuse their own mistakes. But you know what that does to the United States? It isolates the United States. It makes the United States the number one candidate for the label rogue nation. The one who doesn't play fair. The one who doesn't be helpful to us. Our enemy. And that's going to show up right away. The latest statistics show that an enormous decrease in tourism from Canadians is now the reality. As people make reservations in Canada for a summer vacation, you know, a week by the lake or a trip to the Grand Canyon or something, they're not doing it. And they're not coming south from Canada out of a protest against Mr. Trump's threat to make Canada the 51st state. The cost of what he is doing, the risks he is taking, my. I think historians will look back on this and say, as I do, the economic problems of this country must have been extraordinarily profound to generate a government desperate enough to take such enormous risks for a chance that is really small for all of this to work out.
Richard, you mentioned it's going to be so much difficult to get back. And how about, we've learned that China is going to replace the United States with Canada in terms of providing oil to China and soybeans with Brazil. If the things change the way that they're talking about, do you think how difficult that would be for the United States to get back? How much difficult that would be? Are these countries going to change their new sort of trades and get back to the old system? Is there anybody concerned in the United States about that, or they're just thinking of whatever it's in whatever is in their mind?
Well, you know, that's the question the rest of the world is asking, just as the question that half the people in this country are asking: where is the opposition? And the opposition, I have to be honest, the dominant part of the Democratic Party is stunning by its silence. Mr. Biden says hardly a word. Mr. Obama says hardly a word. In fact, the only thing I've seen recently of Obama's is him coming to the defense of Harvard University, but not, you know, dealing with these economic. So I think the rest of the world is seeing very little in the way yet of opposition to the end of a commitment to free trade and the shift to economic nationalism, which is what all of this amounts to. Even Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, their trip around the country, which is impressive and drawing big crowds, seems to be focused on hostility to oligarchs. Okay, I understand that. That's correct. We have an extreme inequality of wealth, and that is certainly a social issue for many people. But there doesn't seem to be a major critique of the economic strategy. So you're left with the feeling that if the Democrats come in, yeah, they will be different. They won't, you know, they won't have Elon Musk firing hundreds of thousands of federal employees. But, you know, even there, they're not, the attack is weak, and the attack is doesn't get much press. It's extraordinary. It's as if everybody is holding their breath, waiting to see if Mr. Trump can get enough going that it becomes politically dangerous to critique him. And since it's not yet clear, we're still in the, you know, we're only 3 months into his presidency, the usual political people don't say much for a fear of being premature or some. So at this point, there's not much opposition. And so to answer your question, foreign leaders and foreign populations are beginning to get the idea that what Mr. Trump is doing is not the peculiarity of Mr. Trump, not even the peculiarity of the Republicans, but is some national agreed change in the United States. And since these things are hurtful to every other country, then you're setting up that the United States is going in a direction that it is willing and able to hurt you when it needs it. Most of the rest of the world thought of the United States for the last 70 years as being the superpower that presides over the world economy, keeping it going the way it has. We have the same, what was the phrase they liked? A rules-based international order. Yeah, okay, translate. The United States makes sure everything happens this way. And you could at least rely on that. You cannot anymore. That's what the world is learning. The United States has difficulties and is willing to try to fix them by behaving in a way that used to be considered unacceptable. I mean, our president announces he's taking a part of the sovereign country of Panama. He's taking a part of the Denmark. They own Greenland. He's thinking of taking Canada. This is a reversion to old style colonialism. You know, and he allies himself with Mr. Netanyahu as if to say, we're prepared in the United States to be as outrageous in terms of global rules of behavior as the Israelis are in bombing Gaza. This is an extraordinary moment for the United States to do that. There are a dozen different solutions in the Middle East that could be worked out between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And the United States could be, as it has been in the past, trying in some way to broker something that might be acceptable to both sides. But instead, it's choosing to line up behind Mr. Netanyahu. First, Biden does it. Trump does it. So the rest of the world understands the United States. Granted, other countries say something but don't do much to stop it. I understand that. A lot of hypocrisy around the world. But at least they say something. The United States cannot bring itself to say something. Even the Canadians are now saying something, but not the United States. And that you have to understand what that symbolizes to the world as it happens right now. No other country has imposed tariffs on everybody else. That's an absolutely unique act of hurting every other country, letting the world know we are going to hit anyone. Are you a poor country in Africa? I know one of them in a little country in the south called Lesotho, which has, I believe, tariffs in the neighborhood of 40 or 50%. This is a desperately poor African. What are you doing? And the amount of trade between Lesotho and this country is trivial. There is no, he needs to show every, there is no limit. Well, you know, it's a little bit like Mr. Netanyahu in Gaza. I'm going to break every apartment building. I'm going to bomb the hospitals. Okay. You are telling us something. And we're not stupid. We see what you're doing. And we, the United States, are going to be behind you in all of this. This is really charming. But you have to understand the United States brands itself a religious country. Our government right now is a government supported in a fundamental way politically by fundamental Christians, particularly, not only, but particularly. Well, you know, the Christian committed government is treating immigrants in a way that no Christian morality that I'm aware of would sanction, would support. I mean, do you treat God's creature, your fellow human being, this way? Throw them out of the country after they've worked here for 20 years? Put them in a jail that is famous for its cruelty? What Christianity is that about? Well, they manage it. And that's a sign that people are desperate. Because I don't believe they want that. I believe those fundamental Christians believe what they say about the Bible. But they are not turning the other cheek. They are not recognizing everybody is equal in the eyes of God. None of that. They are behaving in a way that clashes. How they live with it, I don't know. But the rest of the world is watching and drawing the conclusions, and the United States is going to have to live with them. This behavior, this punishing China, the Chinese Navy is not patrolling our waters. The U.S. Navy is patrolling them. China doesn't have military bases all around the United States. The United States does have them all around China. I mean, who's aggressive here and who isn't? My goodness. Even Americans, lost as they are in the endless repetition of these mistaken notions of what's going on, even they begin to see through it. And you know, it's very dangerous when you do something as a government, even if it's a domestic thing, and people see through it, that opens the space for people to begin to wonder about all the other things you've been telling them if you're not trustworthy. Millions of people have been affected already by the wholesale dismissal of federal employees in this country by Elon Musk. They've been hurt. Their families have been hurt. The communities in which they live have been hurt. They were all told it has to do with efficiency. But, you know, 2 minutes of thought, you will understand that to make something efficient, you have to take some time to really study it, to see how it, none of that was done. You just came in and fired huge numbers of people, cut the budgets. Wow. All right, that's still a small percentage of our people, but they're now talking to other people and thinking they've been abused here. They've been fired even though they've been doing their job for 10 years. No one had a critique. Everyone understood what they were doing. I like to explain to people that in the 1960s, we had 2.5 million civilian employees of the federal government. Now, before Mr. Musk did his thing, we had 2.5 million people, civilian employees of the federal government. Our population is 100 million larger, but the same number of federal employees are taking care of 100 million more people. That's usually called efficient. That's what efficiency means. They'd be the last place you'd go to worry about efficiency, given their record. This is an ideological war undertaken by desperate people trying to hold on to a United States capitalism that is dissolving under them. And they're very frightened, which I understand. And they're desperate, which I understand. But they're acting out their desperation in ways that are not, they're not smart, they're not thought through, they're not likely to work, and they take enormous risks. This is a very dangerous situation. I'm reminded when I was a teenager, I wanted to be a lifeguard during the summer, and I had to take a course at the YMCA about how to be a lifeguard. And the first lesson was, when someone is drowning, when someone is in water over their head and they can't manage it, you have to be very careful how you approach them, because they are desperate and don't really know. They're looking for something to hold on to. And if it's you and you're not, you don't know how to do it, you will be dragged down and we'll have two people who drown instead of one. That was the first, and you know, all of us young men and women, we were very impressed. That's where we are. Only it's the country that's drowning, and we have to be very careful not to be drowned along with it.
Richard, the case of Europe and European countries is of concern, because with the war in Ukraine, and we know that how hard the war and the conflict in Ukraine has hit Europe and its economy. And with the new people wanted some sort of political change. We know what has happened since then. You know, in Germany, they didn't achieve anything. France, United Kingdom, name it. And with the war in with China, with this economic war with China, it seems that the situation gonna worsen. The situation gonna get worse. And do you see any sort of wisdom on the part of Europeans to deal with that, or they're going to get along with whatever comes from Washington in terms of the fight between the two parties, United States and China?
Well, I must say, as a person, you know, both of my parents were Europeans. I was born in the United States, but my father was French, born in France, my mother in Germany. For me, it's the end for you. Europe was in many ways a kind of center of the world, whether you started ancient Greece, the Roman Empire, the medieval time, the colonialism when Europe literally took over the rest of the world or in large parts. This is a sad decline, a tremendous decline. And the ironies here are very rich. Capitalism emerged in Europe in a close relationship with nationalism. The capitalists funded the nationalists so that, for example, the Austro-Hungarian Empire collapses in part because Hungarians become attached to their nationality as Hungarian, and that was more important than the empire, Austro Empire, they were part of. And Germany, likewise. And these countries were put together around nationalism, and it enabled a marriage, if you like, of nationalism and capitalism to overthrow feudalism. Feudalism was held together European-wide by the Roman Catholic Church. And that comes out of the Roman Empire. I mean, the history of Europe is a history of nationalism bringing capitalism to the dominant position. And so here's the irony. It's their nationalism that is now drowning their capitalism. They can't get together. They cannot work out a common policy. The French don't trust the British. Neither of them trust the Germans. The Italians are yet in another place. The Spanish in still another place. The Spanish have been welcoming immigrants. The rest of Europe has been expelling immigrants. You know, Italians are playing with fascism. The French don't want to go there. The Germans don't know what to do with their economic miracle having disappeared. You know, the Germans love to tell themselves about what they call in that country Wirtschaftswunder, the miracle of economic growth or development. But now they're in recession as I speak to you and in deep trouble. And the British, well, catastrophic what they did. And look how desperate they got. They didn't blame the Chinese. The British blamed the Europeans and broke away in Brexit, right? 10 years ago, they broke away as if Europe was their problem. Ridiculous. A level of stupidity that boggles the mind. And they all know it now, too, because, you know, by 10 years later, looking back, wow, was that a mistake? All right. The only thing worse than that was the fact that after World War II, they became slavishly subordinate to the United States. Not only could they not get together, but they all competed to be beloved by the United States. The British had an advantage, English. But they all competed. And then you have this Ukraine war in which the United States gets them to join in a renewal of the Cold War. The communists were gone in 1989. You know, it's over, the USSR. You now have another more or less capitalist regime that wants to participate in some way in Europe. You don't let them, you freeze them out, because you're stuck in the late 20th century. You can't get out of this mentality. And so you fight a war that devastates the economy of Europe. And still you require the leaders to act as if the United States is our beloved leader, no matter how much you destroy us. This is pathological. At this point, you're watching Europeans digging their own grave as we proceed. They can't get together. They are being separated now by the United States, which will pick them off one after the other. In order not to lose all of Europe, they will make deals with whoever. And the Europeans are afraid, any of them, to speak up, because then the United States won't pick them, will pick one of the other ones. Look at the reception of Meloni going to Washington versus Starmer going to Washington. And Starmer comes, you know, on his knees begging. Meloni is more what we want to do. I mean, this is the end. This is the end. Europe cannot find its way. It's embarrassing. Every new technological breakthrough is either coming from the United States or from China. It doesn't come from Europe. You know, and now the Chinese will be trying to sell in Europe what they can't sell here. And they will bring the price down. The Europeans don't know what to do. What are they going to do? Buy it from the United States? No, they're not going to do that. Or maybe they will. Maybe they will become even more subservient. But let me tell you, the American problem isn't going away. And allowing yourself to be the whipping boy, allowing yourself to be damaged by a United States in trouble, invites the United States to do more of that. So be very careful. German companies cannot afford the energy price that you have in Europe. So they've moved production to the United States. They will continue to do that, if not to the United States, somewhere else. And the Chinese will make them offers it will be very hard to refuse. And you're going to see the Chinese doing what the United States does, finding cooperative governments in Europe with whom to make a deal. And then goods can be exported from China to, I'll pick a country, Hungary. And then in Hungary, they can be a little bit further processed. I mean, like put a red stripe of paint on something and then export it to where? To the United States, because the import duty on Hungary is low. And so the Chinese goods can come to the United States. All of that is now being organized. It will be, it's already underway. It always has been underway. Sanctions don't work for that reason. Boycotts tend not to work for that reason. And tariffs are not immune to the exact same procedure. So maybe the United States will have to punish all the countries, started already, punishing the countries that do business with China. All that does now is isolate the United States. The United States makes international trade more expensive, more difficult, and that will not help the United States. Very, very dangerous road we have entered onto.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Richard, for being with us today.
Let me say one more. I don't want to leave people in a depressed state. I don't want to tell you a story. If you want the happy news about how everything's working out, then please go to your regular mass media, your newspapers. They'll give you lots of encouraging good news. But if you want to understand where we really are, then programs like NEMA's here are the place to go, because these are the places where these kinds of conversations are allowed, are encouraged, and we need it more than ever.
Thank you, Richard. Great pleasure, as always. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.